You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
6 years ago, Cambridge University Press published a book by Bjørn Lomborg, The Skeptical Environmentalist, and it inspired many heated debates. Mr. Lomborg, who's a former member of Greenpeace, used statistical information from internationally recognized research institutes to systematically examine a range of major environmental issues, and his conclusion was that the world has actually improved. In his latest book, Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming, he has jumped back into the cultural fray as he asserts that global warming may not be all that bad. His book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Bjørn Lomborg to my show today. Hello.
Hey, Leonard.
You open your book by stating that humanity has caused a substantial rise in atmospheric carbon dioxide levels over the past centuries, thereby contributing to global warming. And this, you say, is beyond debate.
Yes, absolutely.
So what you seem to find debatable is how to best approach the problem.
Yes. It's actually two things. It's both how bad is it going to be? And there, I think the U.S. has had this very unproductive conversation of talking about, is it a hoax or is it a catastrophe? And I think the right answer, as often is in the middle. It's a problem, and it's definitely a problem we need to fix.
Well, and on the governmental level is this something that we should do something about and hurt industry? And also many countries seem to see this as a new opportunity to drill for oil, to have a Northwest Passage. Others are quite horrified that they're going to be making money out of what many see as the potential death of our planet.
Oh, absolutely. And there's all these kinds of arguments bound around. And I think we need to have a sense of, yes, we should do something about it, but we should do both smart things, that is, things that are sustainable and that we can actually convince people to do, but also things that will have long-term impact.
So what current approaches do you feel are a waste of time and money?
Well, for instance, the only real political opportunity there is to deal with climate change right now is the Kyoto Protocol. And that's about cutting emissions fairly soon in industrialized countries to help long-term global warming. The problem with that is it costs a lot of money to cut emissions, especially in rich world countries, right now. So we pay lots of money for this, estimates around $180 billion. Yet it will only have a fairly small effect in only 100 years down the line. Models show that this will postpone global warming by about 5 years at the end of the century. And that's the main problem, that cutting emissions right now costs a lot of money and does very little good.
Is that because only the rich countries would have to do it?
It's partly that.
What about China, which right now seems to be the world's major polluter?
It would definitely be cheaper to cut emissions in China. But the problem, of course, is China is still very poor. I mean, they don't emit nearly as much as Europeans and certainly not as Americans. So per person. So you might say, it's unfair, and that's certainly the way the international argument go. It would be unfair to say that China should be cutting. I mean, we created the problem. But the point that I try to keep back, pulling the discussion back to, is this is not about who's sort of to blame. This is about how do we go from here and actually solve this problem in the long run.
But if everybody else says it's somebody else's problem, then we don't get anywhere. Another example is what's happening in the Amazon, which used to be called the Earth's lungs, but we're seeing it deforested at a shocking rate.
Yeah.
We recently had one of the leading environmentalists from Brazil on, and I think he said it was something like 100,000 football fields every year.
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure about the football fields, but yes, definitely.
I think you said about soccer fields, but still.
Yeah, they're definitely locking a lot in the Amazon forest. And again, the problem here is if you don't have the incentives right, if you have a lot of poor people who need food, and if you have a lot of industry that wants to grow food there, grow soybeans, it's very hard to conserve these areas. So you need to get other structures in. And it's exactly the same thing with climate change. Right now, we want everyone to do something that costs a lot and does fairly little good for everyone else. That's very hard to do. And that's why I'm advocating we should focus much more on research and development and non-carbon or low-carbon emitting energy technologies. If we could get solar panels or windmills or carbon capture to be much cheaper, there's much better chance that we could get everybody on board, and especially, of course, the Indians and the Chinese.
But you also say one of your main criticisms is of environmental organizations because they make selective and misleading use of scientific evidence. In what ways?
Well, I hope that's not a direct quote, but what I try to say is environmental organizations, just like any other interest organization, will go out and say, you know, this is the data that supports my argument. They're arguing for one case. There's, you know, ask teachers organizations, should we have more teachers in schools? They're likely to produce only the information that shows, yeah, you should. But of course, we need to have a sense of proportion. And that's where I think the environmental movement is only telling us one side of the story. Let me give you one example. When we talk about heat deaths, for instance, you know, we're going to see more heat deaths in the coming century because temperatures are going to rise because of man-made global warming. That means more heat waves. That means more heat deaths. But we got to also remember that means that we are going to see fewer cold waves and fewer people dying from cold. We need to hear both of those sides of the argument.
But if we're going to have rising seas, increasingly more powerful hurricanes as a result, intolerably hot weather in areas that now enjoy more moderate weather, then that should be a real cause for concern. And when you watch a film like An Inconvenient Truth and see those glaciers falling off of the ice cap, it's really scary.
Yeah. Absolutely. You asked me two questions there, actually. The first one is, yes, there will be serious consequences, and we need to address those. But my question is still, is the right way to deal with that cutting CO2 right now? And the answer overwhelmingly is no. If you want to help the people, for instance, in France in 2003, the big heat wave that Al Gore also talks about, what should you have done? Well, you shouldn't have done Kyoto. That wouldn't have helped them. It certainly won't help them 100 years from now. It simply means it'll get slightly less more warm in France. That's about making sure that they get more water into France, that they get more, you know, green areas, that they get more white tarmac, for instance, and that they get air conditioning. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to focus on solving climate change in the long run. That's back to the research and development. The other part you talked about, the glaciers, when we see those falling off, that's true. That it looks very, very majestic. I know that most of your senators have been, the 10 senators have been up to Greenland to look at the ice calving off there. Very conveniently, they go to Ilulissat, which is like the biggest and most fastly receding glacier in the Northern Hemisphere. Of course, had they actually stopped where they first landed at Kangerlussuaq, they would actually see an increasing glacier. So, you know, we also see very, very selective uses of those data. Overall, we are losing ice, but we need to get a sense of proportion again. It's going to be sea levels is going to rise about a foot, not 20 feet. And a foot is a problem. But remember, over the last 150 years, sea levels also rose about a foot. Yet it was not the end of the civilization. Actually, I defy most people wouldn't even have remembered that that was one of the important things that happened in the 20th century.
My guest is Bjørn Lomborg. His latest book, Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming, published by Knopf. Well, you're from Scandinavia, from Denmark, the southernmost
My name so well.
You're from the southernmost Scandinavian country, but are people in Scandinavia as sanguine about this as you seem to be?
Oh, absolutely no. I mean, I think Europe is sort of caught in a frenzy of climate change worry. Everybody talks about their carbon footprint. We just enacted anti-smoking laws, which I think is great, in public areas. And one of the main arguments against it was that it was going to increase CO2 emissions because people were going to be sitting outside and then you'd need heaters and that would mean more CO2. It shows you how CO2 has become sort of the organizing principle for much of what we talk about. And I'm simply questioning whether that's a good way to approach everything we think about in the world. CO2 is one problem, but it really only is one.
Well, we'll get to some of the ways we might approach it in a few moments, but I want to get back to the whole matter of movies like An Inconvenient Truth and their impact. Don't you think that it is important to educate the public about what's going on?
Yeah.
And doesn't a film like that do a good job?
I've said, and I'd like to say this again, we should congratulate Gore for his movie that it got the U.S. off from the hoax part. Yeah, global warming is real and it is an important problem.
Although there are still people who claim it's a hoax.
Oh, well, I mean, you're never going to convince
mostly from
everyone,
Exxon,
right?
I think.
But the point is, I think he's perhaps, in his enthusiasm to get everybody on board, I would argue, sometimes have gone overboard in making it this drastic and catastrophe. And I understand why you would want to make it into that. It makes for good pictures. It certainly makes for good publicity.
And it also gets the public mobilized, doesn't it? Which means more money, more interest
devoted
to the subject.
But of course, the problem is we live in democracies where we actually have to make prioritizations between many, many different areas. We need to worry correctly about them. If everybody screams, we don't have a rational conversation. We simply listen to the ones that scream the loudest or have the best or cutest pictures. That's not a good way to make public priority. And that's really why I'm saying we need to cool the rhetoric. And so thanks to Gore for making clear to America that climate change is a problem, but perhaps not so much thanks for making it such an immediate and overwhelming planetary emergency, as he claims.
So how would you go about raising public awareness?
Well, I think if we're going to deal with climate change, we have to be honest. There is very little we can do in the short and even the medium term. This is a long-term problem. Just to give you a sense of the proportion of this, the International Energy Agency, which makes all the statistics for all the national governments in the world, they estimate that right now we use about 13% of our energy consumption from renewable resources, mainly water and biomass. If we don't do anything, just business as usual, by 2030, it'll be 14%. But here's the catch. If we do an immense amount of effort to get to more renewables, more windmills, more solar panels, all that stuff that we seem to think comes out of the climate change debate, we can perhaps push it up, they say, to 15%, one percentage point more. This is about not dealing with the problem by 2030. This is about dealing 2050, 2080. If we're going to get this prolonged effort, it doesn't work to build people into a frenzy and get them doing something right now. This is about making smart moves that can sustain themselves across centuries, across generations, across political parties, and across continents. We can only do that if we do it smart, not if we just build in people's panic.
Countries like Germany are putting solar panels along highways to decrease reliance on petrochemicals. There are other places putting up windmills, although they don't. And I guess there is also a renewed interest in hydroelectric power, also in some cases power plants that are using uranium, which is something that we stopped doing for a while.
Yeah.
Do you see these as all positive steps, or are they all just too small to really change things? Right,
they're
now?
Fine, but we don't get putting up solar panels in Germany is probably along the highways is probably not going to dramatically diminish their requirement for energy. But really, the point here again is to say, look at Denmark. We have a lot of wind energy. We actually are one of the most competitive nations in the world on wind energy. We put up a lot of windmills in the 70s, 80s, early 90s. We felt incredibly good about ourselves. We went around everywhere and bragged about this. The problem was all of these windmills were very inefficient economically. Now we actually produce windmills that are effective. What has happened? Well, we've had to cut down all of these windmills. We're talking about 10,000 windmills and put up new, effective windmills. My point is simply, maybe we shouldn't have put up the first 10,000, but only the second 10,000, the ones that are efficient. And that's the point here, to not have this conversation of doing something that makes us feel good, but actually do the research and development so that we get efficient windmills or efficient solar panels, efficient nuclear reactors, although that's a question whether we can actually get them to be efficient. That seemed to be a very, very hard thing to do. But get there so that we don't have to require our kids or grandkids to be incredibly nice to future generations, but just simply smart.
My guest is Bjørn Lomborg, who is an adjunct professor at the Copenhagen Business School, a contributor to the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and The Economist, and also the founder and director of the Copenhagen Consensus. He has written a book called Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming. It is published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Bjørn Lomborg, whose book Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming is published by Knopf. You used to be a member of Greenpeace. What happened?
Well, I mean, I was a member when I was back in high school and college, and actually, it's very undramatic. I ran out of money as a college student, and I had to get out of everything I was basically paying for. So it wasn't because I dislike Greenpeace. I actually think Greenpeace is a great organization, just like the other green organization. We should definitely be thankful that we have organizations that sort of, you know, make sure that we are aware of all these different problems. The point is just, we shouldn't trust them as our only source of information, because they're interest groups and they will tell you one side of the story or focus on that one side.
You write that distributing money to the world's problems is a zero-sum game. If we said that the world's biggest problems were malnutrition, global warming, AIDS, HIV, malaria, dengue fever, how would you budget for those problems then?
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad you asked me that question. We actually did that in the Copenhagen consensus process. We asked some of the world's top economists to look at where do you get the most bang for the buck. And they basically showed that if you, for instance, invest in prevention of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, you, for every dollar you spend, you could do $40 worth of good. And their top priority list was HIV/AIDS, malnutrition, free trade, and malaria. But they also, and that's the important part, they said, what's the least efficient ways to deal with some of the world's big problems? And they said Kyoto. I was actually impressed that they would go so far as to stake their professional careers in saying, the problem with Kyoto is not that it doesn't do good, but they said for every dollar you spend, you do about 33 cents worth of good.
Well, maybe it's just that Kyoto wasn't thought out well. Maybe we have to come up with another treaty. But should global priorities really be set by a cost-benefit analysis?
I think it should be informed by cost-benefit analysis. You can have other opportunities. I see us as basically providing a price list for the democratic debate. You know, you can go and say, all I want to buy from, you know, the menu I see in the restaurant is beluga caviar, but at least you know that you're going to pay out of your nose for this.
I'm doing something illegal right now, I gather.
Oh, yes. Maybe I shouldn't get into that particular area. But anyway, the idea here is to say that clearly your response is very, very accurate. Maybe the Kyoto Protocol wasn't the right way to do it. Maybe we should have better and smarter ways to deal with climate change. And that's, of course, exactly what I think. It's not about saying climate change is not a problem, but it's about saying the way we deal with it right now makes us feel good, makes every politician look good when you grandstand, but it's actually not going to move us very far towards solving the problem, and at a very high cost.
In your first chapter, you argue that the polar bear, which has become the poster child of global warming, is actually doing well in pure numbers, contrary to what we saw in Al Gore's movie. Although in pure numbers, as the Christian Science Monitor reported, global warming is not killing the polar bears of Canada's eastern Arctic. The number of polar bears has, I think, grown to 2,100, up from 850 in the mid-1980s. The Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which you use in your book, concludes, as the amount of sea ice decreases, seals, walrus, polar bears, and other ice-dependent species will suffer drastically. Yeah. So I'm not sure I understand. Is the decreasing sea ice threatening extinction somewhere in the future, if not at this
now,
moment?
I don't think there, and I think there's a lot of researchers that said that actually just today another team of Danish researchers showed that they think that it's very unlikely that the polar bear will be extinct. But there is a problem for polar bears. All I tried to do in the chapter is to put it in perspective. Allow me just to sort of rewind just a tiny bit and say polar bears probably expanded from about 5,000 of a global population in the 1960s to about 25,000 now. And that shows that while the world was warming, we actually saw a dramatic increase in polar bears. Now, there's no doubt with increasing global warming, they will come under more stress. But the idea then to say, oh, that means cutting carbon emissions is the solution to dealing with climate with the polar bears is a pretty bad solution, and let me explain to you why. The best studied polar bear population is in the West Hudson Bay, where there's about 1,000 polar bears. They've been declining since the late 80s, about 15 polar bears per year. And so the idea is if we did the Kyoto Protocol, for instance, we could probably save about one-half or one-tenth of a polar bear, 0.06 polar bears every year. But I simply question, is that really the best we can do for the polar bear when in the same population we kill 49 polar bears each year? Shouldn't that be our first priority, maybe to stop killing 49 polar bears?
But you also say that the disappearing ice will make polar bears take up a terrestrial summer lifestyle similar to that of brown bears from which they evolved.
Yeah.
But that evolutionary process took thousands of years. And even if we're thinking in zero-sum cost analysis for the moment, we're not thinking long-term. We're thinking, you know, we're thinking about right now, my grandchildren are going to be living in a very different world, aren't they? And do I want to leave that world to them?
Well, that will have to be your answer to question, but I think, I think it's important to say, if we want to help the polar bears, maybe we should stop shooting them before we start talking about climate change.
But I'm all for that.
But when you talk about what kind of a world are we going to leave our grandkids, that's, of course, a much grander discussion, and I think the right one that Al Gore sort of put us on track for talking about, namely saying, okay, imagine the future asking you, what on earth were you thinking? What were you thinking not dealing with the most important problems in the world? I think he's absolutely right in asking us, how do we want to be evaluated by our future generations? But my question is, do we really think future generations are going to laud us for having spent lots and lots of money cutting emissions now, doing very little good 100 years from now, instead of fixing most of the world's important problems right now, HIV/AIDS, malnutrition, malaria, all these other things, and thereby leaving people and thereby the environment much better off, and thereby, of course, leaving their descendants much better able to deal with all the problems that they're going to be facing? So I think, yes, we need to realize that there's going to be problems also for polar bears. We know from the last ice age, from the last interglacial about 100,000 years ago, it was actually warmer than it is today, and yet the polar bears survived. So it's not about their extinction. They will undoubtedly have a problem, but we need to, again, address it smartly, and then we need to move to the global picture and ask ourselves, where can we do a lot of good versus just a little good?
My guest is Bjørn Lomborg. His latest book, Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist's Guide to Global Warming, published by Knopf. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what would you say is perhaps the most cost-effective thing that every person in the world could do right now? It's not switching over to fluorescent light bulbs, is it?
Well, it's fine. That's one of the things that you can do, and that would probably, you know, it'll certainly, you know, make.
I've already done it. Okay.
Yeah. And I've done my part. Yeah, and so have I. And you know, that's fine. It's not the one that's going to save the world and solve the world's problems. There's this great program on BBC in Britain where they asked this guy, a journalist at the BBC NewsHour, to live ethically for a year. He actually got his whole family to do this. They, you know, basically did everything they could, and they documented. It was pretty grueling. You know, he sold his car. They showed how they'd get around in public transport, how their kids would be crying, all that stuff. You know, but they really tried hard. He even looked into organic funerals and, you know, all that stuff. At the end of that year, then they made the assessment. So how much had he actually saved? And the answer was he'd saved about 20% of his carbon emissions. They also asked him, so what are you going to do now you've done? And he said, you know, his first answer was, well, they'd all bought tickets for Jamaica. You know, they were going to sort of celebrate, probably blowing their entire carbon budget. And what this shows is it's very hard for individuals to do this. This is not about individuals as much as it's about making sure you elect governments that will make good long-term strategies to make societies work in a more efficient way.
I mentioned that they're going to fly to Jamaica. Now, every time we fly, don't we do serious damage to the environment? And environmentalists fly all over the world. And people who say it's a hoax fly all over the world. We're all flying.
And of course, the point is, if you look at most people, they like to fly. They like to have this opportunity. And again, we need to get a sense of proportion. Most people believe that flying is one of the major sources of climate change. No, not so. By the UN estimates, it's about 2-3% right now. Even with the dramatic increase that we expect in flying, both because people get much richer, because flying gets cheaper, and because we will be many more people, by 2050, it'll be less than 5% of the climate change impact. Again, what this shows is cutting emissions and making sure that we have the right structure by the end of the century is not about cutting all the fun. You could still imagine flying. The point is you need to make sure that you have structures, and that's especially industry, heating, and many of the infrastructure points. You know, how do you transport goods and services around the country and around the globe? That is where we need to invest in research and development so that we get better opportunities to both utilize wind and solar, maybe fission, as you talked about, maybe fusion, certainly carbon capture so that we can capture the CO2, especially from coal, and that we can use a lot of coal, as they call it, clean coal. That is very expensive right now. Most of these things I just mentioned are fairly expensive right now. But what we should make sure is we make them cheap so our kids and grandkids have a fairly low-cost solution to climate change.
You mentioned earlier that the Copenhagen Consensus ranked all the opportunities for getting the most from our dollars, and they came out with prevention of HIV/AIDS as number one. You formed the Copenhagen Consensus. Is that basically the function of your organization?
It is to get people to think about priorities, yes. We're doing this on a global basis every 4 years, but now we're actually doing a Copenhagen Consensus for Latin America next month in Costa Rica, where we're looking at, you know, should you invest in crime prevention or in democratic institutions or in poverty alleviation or more education, that kind of thing. So it's about getting people to think about priorities in all kinds of different areas. We're also doing it for the Europe's environment. We're doing it for individual nations like Azerbaijan and Zambia. So we're doing this all over the world. Yeah.
Well, our listeners keep on calling in and asking the same question. Why can't we do all of these things? Why do we have to choose?
Yes, that is a great question. And of course, in principle, we could. We are rich enough to deal with all problems of the world. But look at what has happened over the last 40 years. We haven't. We haven't actually figured out we haven't spent money on all the world's problems. And when we focus on some of these problems more, it means that we end up focusing less on some of these other problems. I'm happy to say right now we probably spend about $100 billion a year globally on doing good on the planet. Now, don't we want to spend that money the best possible way? But of course, many people would then say, well, but we're spending $100 billion in the Iraq war. Why don't we also spend that on doing good? I mean, apart from the fact that it might be hard to get that off the Bush grip, but, you know, allow us to believe that we could get that extra $100 billion. Wouldn't we still want to use that in the best possible way?
I suspect after some president ends the war in Iraq, that money isn't going to go to ending global warming.
Or to HIV/AIDS prevention or any other thing, you know, because most of us are fairly egotistical. We're going to spend most of our money on ourselves, you know, on hospitals or health, you know, or infrastructure or something else. But I'm simply arguing, no matter how much money we spend on doing good in the world, we should have a conversation about where does it do the most good.
We've been talking a lot about tipping points in recent years. How would reaching the tipping point of runaway greenhouse effect make it impossible to turn things around?
That is a good question, and unfortunately, we don't know the answer to that. The point, however, is For instance, we had a big discussion about the Gulf Stream tipping. You remember the movie The Day After Tomorrow, which, by the way, was a great, you know, special effects movie.
But it happened a little too quickly.
Well, yes. But actually, the UN Climate Panel now says and feel comfortable enough to say that's just not going to happen. Now, there might be other tipping points out there, and we certainly want to know about those. But the question is still, how much change can we actually affect through our climate change policies? And the answer is very little right now, but in the long run, possibly we can do much more. And again, that's about making smart policies.
We're going to end with a question from a listener. What does an associate professor of statistics who has no background in scientific research related to biology, ecology, or environmental science know about global warming? His arguments are not peer-reviewed. He has no authority on the subject. And I guess you have to answer that.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd be happy to do that. You should not believe me. You should believe what the arguments I say simply because I use them from the UN climate panel. I say I'm not an expert on the science part. I'm simply using what the UN climate panel is telling us about 1 foot of sea level rise, not 20, not zero. But I do have an expertise in talking about what are the economic impacts of this. And I think it's much more, and that's also what we talked mostly about, it's much more about how do we then approach this problem and deal with it effectively throughout this century. So don't trust me, trust the UN climate panel on the natural science impacts, but also have a conversation about how should we best deal with this problem.
Björn Lomborg's book is called Cool It, The Skeptical Environmentalist Guide to Global Warming. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, pleasure to be here.